I think we should get this show on the road. I know we're going to have more of our colleagues here, as I saw Commissioner Fish in the hall, but we'll get started. Susan, we're also waiting on Susan. Maybe we won't get started. Let's wait a minute then. Put you on the spot, Joe. Yeah, that's right. More Monty Python. Yes. There she is. We just got to get some. Yes, she did. Sure. Hey there. Okay. Got a quorum. And a planning director. What else do we need? Quorum, a map, and a planning director. That's enough. More than sufficient to the task. Well, welcome everybody. This is the third of our work sessions on the recommended comprehensive plan. I think we're going to have at least two more. Purpose of these work sessions is to get the council grounded in some of the decisions that we have to make today, particularly to go deeper into the economic development and environmental issues in the draft plan. This is, of course, a work session in which we work with our staff and key volunteers. We won't be taking public testimony, but obviously there's some folks here to sit in, and we welcome you. We're going to have public hearings in November and December. This particular part of the plan is really important because we have to create an employment environment that supports our citizens. We're projected to grow by, I'll get the second and third digits wrong, but 200,000 more people and at least 120,000 more jobs. So that's something we have to accommodate in both cases. We also have a PDC strategic plan that was changed in a significant way when we worked on it earlier this year, and that is that it stresses placemaking, job growth, and shared prosperity. So the issues of equity and its inclusion of more people in our community in more parts of the economy are pretty important because we do have a racial and ethnic income gap. So those are some of the issues that we're focusing on. It's about more than job growth, of course. It's also about centers and corridors and greenways and habitat and watersheds. So again, this afternoon, we're going to focus on those two broad areas of industrial land and growth and resource land and habitat protection, which have from time to time been in some conflict in our community and others as we discuss these issues. So that's why we're here this afternoon. That's the set of focal points for today's work, and I'll turn it over to Susan Anderson and her team to start the briefing and start the discussion.
Okay, thank you, Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you for joining us. I'm joined by, first of all, I'm joined by Mike Abate, I think Patrick is here, and Jane Beccieri, who helped to work on all of this for the past couple of years. Also Michelle Redd and Mike Hauck from the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and also Joe Zender, Eric Engstrom, and Tom Armstrong. Before they jump into all the numbers and the background and information, and we're going to lay out a lot for you today, I want to just kind of lay out briefly what the three topics are that we're going to cover today. So environment, economic development, and most importantly, the balancing of those two things. Let me start with the issue of balance first, what it officially means in terms of the comprehensive plan. Goal number one of the comp plan calls for us to recognize that there are lots of other goals. There's housing and transportation and economic development and so on, and that each of them are distinct, and sometimes they are very complementary to each other and build on each other, and sometimes they are somewhat at odds. Goal number one that's required by the state tells us that it's not the role of the comprehensive plan to do the balancing. That role falls to us. It falls to you. And so over the past couple of years in developing the plan, probably no other topic has really gotten quite as much attention as trying to figure out how do we balance and find complementary places where the environment and the economy can actually help each other. So in response, more than 2 years ago, we put together a group that met often. and it included economic development advocates and specialists, and then also environmental advocates, scientists, and specialists. We had started out with two separate groups and soon found out we needed to pull sort of a subcommittee together because we wanted this to move farther than if it had been in silos. They definitely didn't agree on everything, but they did learn a lot from each other, and they came a lot closer on several different issues. One of the things that they generally agreed on was that a healthy environment and healthy people absolutely depend, at least to some extent, on a community that has good jobs. So you need those things, and they depend on each other. And on the flip side, that there was much agreement that to be truly prosperous, we have to build a low-carbon economy over the next couple decades. So together, there's a lot of balancing to do. Let me talk specifically about chapters 6 and 7 that are referred to in your packet. Chapter 6 is all focused on economic development. Its policies support healthy economy, the things that you would think generally would be in there. Also, policies to expand economic opportunity for all Portlanders. So this chapter recognizes also that Portland's economy is very diverse. We have manufacturing and industry and hospitals and institutions and retail, all sorts of different kinds of businesses. We are definitely not a one-company town. We are not the town that we were, 30 or 40 years ago when we were very timber-dependent. Chapter 6 also recognizes that different geographic areas of the city have very different needs. So in the plan, you'll find specific policies around economic development in the central city versus industrial areas versus institutions and our neighborhood business districts. There's also a lot of overall policies that affect sort of all of these areas. A couple of those I want to highlight is the need to provide an adequate supply of land for each sector, the need to continue to focus on exports to bring new dollars into our economy, and the need to pay close attention to household prosperity and incomes, especially providing for middle-wage jobs that don't necessarily require a four-year college degree. So that's industrial jobs, but also some tech jobs and potentially healthcare tech workers that also are two-year degree jobs. So that's chapter 6 on one end. On the other side, sort of chapter 7 is focused on the environment, and on specifically we're going to talk about watershed health today. Four key messages I want you to remember about that chapter is that we need to commit to protect and improve Portland's air quality and water quality, our natural resources and biodiversity, that we want to support weaving nature throughout the city. It's not something that's in a park over there, and there's none throughout our community. Mike will remind us of that hourly, and we're glad he does, for hourly. That we want to recognize that a healthy economy and a healthy environment and healthy people, that those things are all connected and that they depend on one another. And finally, again, that it's essential that cities take action on climate change. So healthy tension between these two, environment and economy. I feel like I'm back at my sweet spot. I have a degree in economics and a degree in environmental science, and for 30 plus years, I've been in this place of this healthy tension is, I think, where some of the most creative and fun and really important work in the world can happen. What I want to remind you as we're going through the rest of this information is, again, this idea of balancing. No single policy trumps another. Jobs don't beat environment. Environment, clean air and water don't necessarily trump jobs. That's what we do. When you make decisions, and that it's the context that's important. So as after we adopt this plan, and this is all stuff you already know because you deal with it currently often, as land use decisions do come before you, or they come before the Planning and Sustainability Commission, you need to balance these different goals and policies on the whole in terms of does it reach the goals we're trying to get to, and look at the specific facts and context in each situation. So I'm going to turn it over to Tom and Joe and they're going to inundate you with information. And a lot of this is going to be focused on growth projections over the next 20 years. What the mayor was talking about in terms of the about 140,000 jobs we think are going to come, how many of those are industrial, what kinds of jobs are they, what kind of people and what sectors of the economy are going to be affected, how fast is demand for the port going to grow in terms of their forecast, in terms of how we've looked at it, what commodities does that impact, all of those kinds of things. So a lot to cover in about an hour. And most importantly, as you're listening to all of this, keep in mind that in an hour or so, we're going to lay out three scenarios for you to think about. And you don't need to make a choice, obviously, today, but in the next coming months, you need to think about these three scenarios in terms of growth and in terms of the various levels of public investment that are required in order to be able to use and reach the goals we have around industrial jobs and other jobs in the community. So, Tom, Joe.
Well, good afternoon, commissioners and mayor. I'm Joe Zender, chief planner with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So this first section, we're going to lay out some of the fundamentals about employment and its characteristics and the trends. And then Tom's going to talk about the other part of this equation, land supply, how we calculated it and set it up in the EOA. Question and answers around that foundational work, and then we'll talk about the strategy. So, and just like we've done in the previous work sessions, we have virtual some slides that are in your briefing book that just will be data slides that we talk from. First point, and you've heard this already a variety of times, that we have a very fairly diverse economy in Portland, especially in terms of the industrial sectors in which employment is concentrated. And that's on the first two are on your handout from today. And you can see that our largest sectors are industrial, office, and healthcare and education, and that this diversity in the economy and diversity in employment sectors actually adds to the resilience of the city. Different sectors perform differently in sort of different parts of the business cycle. It's a good thing. Secondly, what's been happening lately, or most recently, in terms of change in employment by sector? In 2013, we recovered the city's employment, or it's actually, these are Multnomah County numbers, recovered from the Great Recession, 22,000 jobs that we lost, we had gained back by 2013. And since 2013, there's been about another 20,000 jobs added to the local economy. So the recent performance has been good. Where those jobs have been coming from in the most recent round is healthcare, where from 2000 to 2013, healthcare and education added about 23,000 jobs. So you're going to see policies in here focused on that particular sector. There's also significant gains in professional services in the category of the last 15 years, and the kind of things that are in that category that have been growing are things like marketing, design services, software, and web design, and some of those are what you just made space for in the Central East Side with the employment overlay. So in the comprehensive plan, we take that, we're planning for 140,000 more jobs in the city by 2035. We take this sort of look of where employment is taking place by type of industry, and we have to translate it to geography, because at the ultimate end, the comprehensive plan needs to identify a land supply. So this diagram is showing you how we made that conversion. Oh, I'm sorry, this one's in your package as well. I'm sorry. This is in the front pocket, and then after that, we head into the pages. Yeah, got it? So this is a page out of the draft comprehensive plan, and it's just showing you of those 395,000 jobs, where they're distributed across the different geographies that we've come up with to characterize the mix of places, types of space, and industries. So 23% are in lands that we consider to be our industrial land supply, predominantly heavier industrial, 33% in the central city, and you can see the rest. We've identified really four major types of places: central city, neighborhood business districts, industrial area, and the institutions that I've already mentioned. So now I just want to touch on two sort of trends are two issues that have affected the recommendations that you're seeing in the comprehensive plan vis-a-vis economic development and environment. And first is the shrinking middle wages that we're experiencing in Portland and other places. And this is going to be page two in the packet in terms of the graphic, right behind the outline. So here, so the top graphic on that page, what you're seeing is over from 2005 to 2014, how employment has grown across three sort of levels of wages. And you can see in this diagram the Great Recession and the employment losses that took place then. You can see the recovery after that, where you're seeing across all three low wage, middle wage, and high wage groups recovery. But what you'll also see here is that most of the recovery has been in the high wage category and in the low wage category. The response, the recovery in the middle wage category, the losses were greater and the recovery has been less. And you hear about this issue often in the comprehensive plan. When we look at our mix of industries, it's raising issues regarding the middle class, the income equity across the city. The way this translates into a comprehensive plan.
Yeah. Why did we do so well in the high wage jobs right after the recession compared with the rest of the United States?
Well, it's the mix of businesses and which growth that the businesses were in. It's which kinds of companies are recovering.
Yeah, it's been the software development in the central city and healthcare, particularly that expansion, as well as some of the office recovery that we've seen. As opposed to, you know, with the middle wage jobs, the manufacturing has been the slowest to recover.
I don't know the numbers. Yeah. And Tom, Commissioner Fish just asked for us to provide sort of the wage ranges that constitute these three. I don't know them off the top of my head. This situation that we're looking at here is not unique to Portland. This is happening nationally as well. So when we translate it to how the growth in our different types of industrial sectors or employment sectors affect this, you can see in this somewhat complicated graph that the gray bars are our industrial sector, and these sloping lines are how the gradient of wages works. So for instance, for industrial, which is that gray arc, you can see that it's concentrating its employment in these middle wage jobs. So growth in that sector has this particular benefit in terms of addressing the issue that I just spoke about. The other sectors perform differently in that regard. Second issue I just wanted to touch on, once again, is an equity issue, which is how our location of employment and location of working households match up in terms of access to employment opportunities and the equity components of that. One overall measure of this is how well employment opportunities are served by transit in different parts of town. And this graphic that's on the next page, the fold-out map of your briefing book, shows in the darker purple more concentration of jobs with better access to transit. And the gradient goes out from the central city to lower concentrations and lower access. So someone in the you're scored for having better access to transportation and employment if a living wage jobs in the regions that someone can access within a 60-minute one-way transit trip. That's what got you a score in this particular analysis. The next map in your packet on page 4 shows something related but different. And this is where residents in East Portland are finding employment in the region. And here, that particular graphic works like a heat map, where the red, the hotter colors, are where there's a greater concentration of employment of households who live in the area outlined in red on the map, that section of East Portland. And you're going to see there's a concentration in the Columbia Quarter. There's a concentration in our institutional uses, particularly the hospitals. And if you remember the previous map, you'll notice that especially from East Portland back to Columbia Corridor, a transit-dependent community, not very well served on that particular access to those jobs in terms of transit to the extent that matters. And then transit to these other more far-flung institutional hospital locations can be good in some cases and not so good in others. So the point of this is that as we've done the comprehensive plan, we've looked at not just the supply and demand and having an adequate supply of land, but also having it arranged in a way that can promote the equity agendas of the Portland PAND and the comprehensive plan. Finally, where are we growing in terms of the numbers? And this is probably the next page in the workbook, page 5. Thanks, Tom. So this takes that 140-some-thousand jobs and breaks it into those geographies. And you can see, just like our current economic sort of composition, our growth across these areas is relatively balanced. And to meet the forecast, like this forecast of 140,000 new jobs doesn't happen if we just sit back and wait. There's policy actions that we need to be able to demonstrate to the state and metro and to ourselves that we're increasing the employment capacity of the city and meeting that demand. And this is the sectors in which we're going to do it. And remember, we're a landlocked city. So at the heart of all of our strategies this time is not somehow growing the amount of land in the city. It's getting more production out of the land that we have, targeting sectors that have impacts like wages, but sectors that are grow and grow at higher employment densities. Those are the policy levers that we have to play with. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tom.
Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we call the economic opportunities analysis. This is a background report. It's required by the state. It is where we take our jobs forecast and look at our buildable land inventory, the land supply, and how we mesh that together to identify and to essentially prove to the state that we have an adequate supply of land to meet the jobs forecast. And so when we get to November 19th in the public hearings, there's really two public hearings going on. The first one at 2:00 is on the EOA and the background report and the assumptions that go into it. And then the second hearing is about the goals and policies and map that's in the recommended comprehensive plan. So I'm going to dive here into the numbers. The EOA really has four sections. We did a sort of a trends analysis, looking at local and national job trends and development trends. And then we developed what we call our employment land needs. We take the job forecast from Metro's regional allocation, the 142,000 jobs, and we look at how that plays out in our city and what the development trends tell us in terms of which sectors are growing and how fast they're growing. And then we do, and if you're looking on pages 6 and 7 of the handout, what we have to do is sort of mash this up to come up with different geographies where those jobs are, and different geographies such as the central city or the industrial areas have different sort of land needs per job and a different job mix of office and production and retail. And so we push all that together to come up with what we call different geographies on the map. In essence, we sort of boil those down to four main areas that we talked about: the central city, the industrial areas, the neighborhood commercial districts, and our major institutions. And we look at what's the job forecast, how we think that will grow, what's the demand for land, and then in the third section of the EOA, we look at what's our land supply. What's our land supply under the current plan and current zoning? What vacant land do we have out there? What is potentially redevelopable because of low-value improvements, primarily? We also, as part of that land supply analysis, look at what constraints are out there today. Are there physical constraints, like wetlands or steep slopes? Are there infrastructure constraints, such as streets needed or water or sewer service? We look at other constraints like brownfields and try and factor in the development cost to clean up brownfields. And that sort of reduces the current capacity of those lands. And we factor all that in to come up with a land supply, and then we compare it to the demand from the forecast to come up and identify whether or not we have a surplus of capacity or a deficit. And it's important that constraint analysis really takes us from just looking at gross acres and gross parcel sizes to what we call, for lack of a better term, a capacity acre. So if you had a 10-acre parcel and say it backs up to the Columbia Slough or it has a steep slope, we may, in our buildable land supply, only count that as a 5 acres of really developable land. And so when we talk about these numbers in these tables, it's really that constrained capacity. It's not just gross land footprint. When we go through this analysis with the current plan, we've identified sort of three areas where we were short. We have a shortfall. One of the areas was the Central East Side and the Central City Industrial Area. And that is largely solved through the Southeast Quadrant Plan and the expansion of the Employment Opportunity Sub-Area. Another area where we were short were for our major campus institutions, especially those outside the Central City, the hospitals, the higher ed, the major higher ed institutions. For that, we've actually, as part of the comp plan and part of the zoning implementation, have come up with a new designation for those hospitals and colleges. We're coming up with a new base zone for them to create the capacity to meet that future growth. And so we think we've found a way to solve that. The third area is around our industrial land, and we'll get into the strategies that we worked on with our industrial land watershed health work group on how we propose and the PSC recommends we close that gap to the point where if we implement all our strategies over 20 years, we expect to have about a 92-acre surplus. A key part of this in the industrial area is the land demand has two components to it. One is about the job growth that we expect there, and another is about the commodity flows or the cargo, because Portland is a major freight hub. And in our industrial area, we have a combination of the airport, the marine ports, two major national railroads come together, two major interstates come together. And so there's a certain amount of land demand that's associated with just moving goods. And it's pretty low job density, but those facilities support the rest of the job growth in the industrial area and businesses across Portland, the region, and the state. And so to sort of estimate what that future need is, we get into a commodity forecasting or cargo forecasting. And a lot of this work was done around the discussions about the need for West Caden Island. And so we've incorporated some of that cargo forecasting work to sort of estimate that land demand. And this is where we get into sort of the three scenarios, the three choices that you all have. And for that, Eric is going to take us through a deeper dive on how we arrived at those three scenarios.
Thanks, Tom. So as Tom said, in the harbor access lands, which, by the way, is the orange geography within that's the land that's directly got access to the river, this was one of the more discussed elements of the land supply question with the Planning Commission. And as Tom mentioned, it's less about employment density and more about commodity movement and the flow of goods in and out of the city or to the rest of the state or out of the rest of the state. It's important to note that this isn't just the Port of Portland. There are other private entities in this geography like Gunderson and the private grain terminals or the oil terminals. So when we talk about commodity movement, what we're talking about is, again, the movement of raw materials and Tom mentioned why we kind of have a role in this as a region, because we're the only place in the state or in the city that, or in the region, I mean, sorry, that where we have this convergence of the harbor, the freeways, the rail systems, and the pipelines all in one geography. When we talk about in the world of sort of ports and railroads and trucking, the things that are being moved in and out are categorized either as grain or mineral bulks or liquids or cars or containers or other stuff that doesn't fit in a container. So all of our analysis is based on these different commodity types, and that was one important step in figuring out our land supply need related to commodity movement. There's a table in your handout that walks through the sequence that we used in a general way to calculate this need, and so I'll just describe that. Thanks, Joe. The first thing we looked at is what are the forecasts for the whole Columbia River, and there are trade forecasts for different geographies in the world, and there are trade forecasts for the Columbia River. Second, we look at what is Portland's expected share of that movement, because there are other ports along the Columbia besides Portland. We also look at what capacity we already have in our existing terminals. Some commodities, our existing terminals have plenty of capacity to handle our expected needs over the next 20 years, and we're painfully aware that the container terminal, for example, is unlikely to run out of room in the next 20 years, given where we are right now. So that's not one of our land needs, container terminals. We then look at how much is left over that is going to drive demand for potential new terminals or new land consumption over the next 20 years. Finally, we look at different kinds of terminals have different footprints. Car terminals or mineral bulk terminals use up more land generally than a grain terminal. We also consider whether we're incorporating what I describe as modern rail access or whether we're going to make do with some lower level of transportation access to that facility, and that has an impact on the needed footprint. Smaller facilities may be possible, but just less profitable or harder to finance.
So I might stop you there, just get you to make sure you go back up to this level of altitude on the question. As earlier this week, as it happens, we had a presentation by our city's economist about the situation of the city's financial picture, and he had a bunch of indices of progress or lack thereof, all of which were positive. Employment growth, wage growth, unemployment decline, so on. They're all, plus 5, plus 12, minus 35 on freight access because of the loss of the container port. Mm-hmm. So I know Susie's here, and I mean, it'd be good. I know you've been coordinating with the port. But meanwhile, while we've lost our container port and that part of our local economy has taken a nosedive, Brooklyn Yards is being modernized, and they're building a Y for the rail system over here on the Central East Side so that there's freight access by rail. And meanwhile, there's a huge amount of Port of Portland land available at Troutdale for a larger rail yard if need be. So is it reasonable to forecast at this point that we will be an expanding seaport, or rather that will be an expanding rail port in terms of the movement of goods to and from the metropolitan area and from the city? If I were to look at the situation in the last 2 years where we lost our container port, I haven't heard any news about its restoration, and where the railroads are making significant investments in their proprietary facilities for moving freight, it would seem to me, at least a possible scenario, that we're not going to be that much of a seaport in the future, and we are going to be a rail port, and that has implications for regional land supply, some of which won't be met inside the city limits of Portland. So,
yeah. I think, Mayor, the answer to that is that it a little bit is different trends with different commodities. As you mentioned, the container commodity movement is not growing. In the end, our analysis found that the places where we had the most likelihood of an unmet need were in grain in grain or bulk minerals or in autos, not in containers or the liquid bulks or other things like that. And so we narrowed down to a subset of commodities and said, if we're going to grow, these are the most likely growth areas. Growth in the recent past has been slower than in the past when you look at the overall trends in commodity movement. So that question is a reasonable one. It's if you look at the backside of this handout that we gave you today that has this chart, the blue line on this is just port growth, not the entire harbor, so it's a little bit it's lower than it would be otherwise. But it shows the different range of forecast growth that could be that was projected by the different studies. So definitely we're, you know, especially in the last few years, underperforming relative to those forecasts. So that does, you know, beg that question.
Trend lines take off from this baseline.
Because we did that study a few years back. We did that study in 2012, and so we didn't have the more recent data. And also they take off from the total harbor tonnage, not just the port tonnage. So there is a higher trend line there in the history that is beyond just the port. We didn't have access to all that data for this chart. But essentially, we're flatter than we should be to be on that track. And that's one of the points we want to make today, is that that's partly why the Planning Commission felt comfortable with the lower forecast.
So two things to take from that is, one, that the reality of how much the forecast is set at with these low, medium, and medium high sort of scenarios, and where we've actually been, and the past doesn't always predict the future, but this is a pretty long trend line. And then the other issue is around what commodities are we short land for, and how much of an impact did those have, those commodities, on our local economy. So there's a difference between shipping potash from Canada, perhaps, than shipping grain from Eastern Oregon in terms of how does it affect our economy. So when we get to that level of detail, I think it'll be important to at least kind of highlight what it is we're shipping and what kind of impact that has on the creation of local jobs.
And that was definitely part of the Planning Commission's discussion. The Planning Commission looked at a couple alternatives, including going with the low forecast. They also looked at going with the medium forecast, but assuming more compact terminals, and so potentially having a grain terminal, but without a modern rail loop, or having a car terminal, but with additional vertical storage, which is a different cost equation. But so they looked at that option, and then they looked at what would it take to meet the medium forecast with a modern rail loop, and that's where the question of West Haden Island came into the discussion. And in that inventory of land in the harbor, that being the one remaining site that's large enough for that kind of infrastructure. The Planning Commission concluded, based on where we are with West Haden Island, that it is not likely in the next 20 years, and they recommended a farm forest zoning designation and land use designation in the interim without specific policy governed about annexation in the future. Doesn't preclude it from happening, but it doesn't set us up for rapid movement towards that. We did not count West Haden Island in our land supply as a result. So that was part of the discussion at the Planning Commission, definitely, is where we are with the viability of movement on West Haden Island. Those different assumptions, those different scenarios result in different shortages and surpluses, and the result, depending on which point you choose in that, we end up with a different job result. Back to what Susan said, it isn't all the jobs in the city, obviously, and it's just growth, not all of them. So you do have the ability to move jobs from one sector to the other. This is largely a question of how much that is occurring and where that's occurring. There's the chart that is on page 8 describes some of those trade-offs in terms of what surplus and you end up with in different situations. The low forecast with modern optimal terminal designs leads you to the total surplus of industrial land surplus of 95 acres. If you go with the medium but more compact designs, you end up with 85. Medium with a rail loop, you're 125 acres short overall. 10, sorry. So that concludes my general description of that. I think at this point we were going to shift.
I think just one more point on all of this, and what we recognize through this process is, and looking back, is that when it comes to the economy and jobs, it's harder to predict and forecast. And the metro jobs forecasts have been much more variable. They've been pretty good about the population and the residential forecasts over the long term. The economy is much more up and down. And there's a lot of uncertainty as we come out of the Great Recession and how we're recovering and how both the national and regional economy is changing. And one of the things that we sort of clearly recognize in here, both within the EOA and in the policies, is that we need to keep looking at these job trends and how we're going, and we need to update this level of analysis every 5 to 7 years as Metro comes out with their new regional forecasts, so that we can stay on top of it and we can make mid-course corrections, and so that it isn't a let's set this forecast for 20 years and we'll come back later and look at it. We want to keep it fresh and we want to keep tracking these trends.
When I first looked at this chart on page 10, and I'm still puzzled, why is there only a 10-acre difference in the industrial land need between the low and medium scenarios? That looked like a typo to me.
No, the key is that there are two ways to meet the medium forecast. One is to annex West Hidden Island, and the other is to assume smaller footprints for each of your terminals. So that middle one there is assuming the same number of terminals, but it's making a different assumption about how much acreage you need for each of those terminals. And that will involve, it's not what the market might do by itself, so it may involve some kind of public subsidy or incentive to convince a grain operator to locate in Portland, even though they're going to end up with a less than optimal rail loop, for example. And so you physically can do, and there are grain terminals, for example, that operate that way. But in a competitive market, it may require some intervention to get them to do that.
So another way of looking at that is we're getting more cargo out of the same sort of footprint size of terminals, higher productivity out of the terminals. Much larger port markets have accomplished that. It would be, probably a stretch for us, but it has been and can be done. And you know what it's comparable to? Remember when we didn't believe that we were going to be able to produce the housing numbers we need through compact development? This would be sort of positing the next generation of that, but related to a port facility or an industrial facility.
But it would require significant public investment. And we want to look at exactly to help you in this decision making, how does that compare to the public investment for West Hayden Island, for example? How much is that? And we're not going to get it, but we'll at least get a range of numbers for what that looks like.
Thank you, Susan. That was actually the question I was going to ask. I mean, as Transportation Commissioner, as a citizen, I look at, hey, there's a medium forecast we can have without West Hidden Island. Great, tastes great, less filling. It's the Miller Lite option. But then the two questions are going to be, one, does the port think that's realistic? And another question is, when it says additional freight investment more, well, how much more and what is the price tag for us? And you're saying that we don't really know the answer to that yet at the have a question on the brownfield reclamation, 125 acres. What assumptions are we making about new or more robust tools going forward in order to reach that goal?
Can you hold that question for the second half of this, and we'll go through each of those strategies and explain those assumptions?
I will do whatever you say.
Okay.
Another West Staten Island question, and I say this recognizing that my couch is right here, and I'm trying to like stay out of fist range. But aren't there a whole mess of other, just like there's a whole mess of plans out there that assume there'll still be a CRC? Aren't there a mess of other plans that continue to assume that Hayden Island is in the industrial land mix?
At the regional level, there are policies and policy direction that are conflicting from Metro. But yes, Metro does include 300 acres of industrial land capacity in their urban growth report when they decide how to size the urban growth boundary. Their policy direction to us is plan it for both industrial and address the natural resources. And it says, and then the policy says, city and port, go work it out in a plan district. And we're still working on it.
And in terms of this still working on it issue, I mean, you're saying that, I mean, the low forecast sort of implicitly assumes that there's not going to be development in West Titan Island in the, well, one version of it, unless you go with the modern, and within the next 20 years. I mean, I wasn't here. My recollection is that before I got here, the city council said there's going to be no more than 300 acres of development with a whole bunch of environmental sidebars. And then there was a proposal that the PSC came up with that said, here are the mitigation measures that would be necessary to do those 300 acres. And the port said that wasn't economically feasible. I kind of thought that at some point there might be another discussion where the port came forward with a specific proposal, and we might look at how much property tax revenues that would generate, and then maybe there might be a discussion of the city making up the difference in the cost of mitigation through property tax revenues. So obviously that discussion is not about to happen anytime soon, but I didn't think that we'd precluded it, and so I did have a question about whether if we adopt one of these scenarios, are we precluding that conversation?
And I just want to dive in to correct your beginning assumption. I wrote, or helped to write, the 2011 resolution, and it directed the Planning Commission and the Planning Bureau to look at, could you do a 300 and 500 scenario, and if so, what should the mitigation be? It didn't say, go ahead and do it.
And I think what happened in terms of what happened at the Planning and Sustainability Commission, so this was many, many, many hours of discussion. And when we were closely looking at, you know, as we were updating forecasts and we're looking at the low forecast and realized without West Hayden Island, we were still okay, it sort of made it fall off the table a little bit. It didn't say that it wasn't going to happen. It said in the next 20 years, and that's what this plan is about, we don't have to go there and invest all of those additional dollars, public dollars, to get there. And so that's the decision that they came up with. And others, you know, there were a range of opinions on that, but that was what came out of the commission.
And I think to add on to that, the other piece that became clear is that we do need significant investments in the current harbor. That was part of the North Reach plan that came with a price tag of $500 million for infrastructure investments. Part of my thought is let's do those and invest in our current harbor before we start looking at should we be putting a rail terminal on West Hayden Island.
And just to build on that, to be clear, the proposed strategy that we'll get into later does include the need to invest significantly in the existing harbor in order to make this work.
And then just finally, there's no policy, there's nothing in the plan that precludes West Hayden Island from happening sooner. It maintains the status quo in terms of what the map says and what the policy is. We can pick this up whenever the port thinks it's ready to try again. But there is no express policy that says, yeah, let's do West Hayden Island in the next 20 years.
So you're going to move. You're not. Are you ready to move on to natural resource stuff?
Yeah, and then how those kind of.
Okay. So one other question I want to, or set of questions I want to pose, at a little finer grain on the industrial land issue is, at this point, we're not. Your tables in your three scenarios involve retention of land, intensification of land, brownfield reclamation, golf courses. Okay, so another one I want you to put on the list and explain why it's not on the table, and that is conversion of land zoned currently for general commercial purposes to industrial. We have dead Kmart here, dead motel there, large sites, unused, lots of asphalt. I know there's a downzoning and compensation issue, but it might be less expensive to compensate owners for loss of value than it would be to build expensive infrastructure.
Okay, so we will talk about those issues and the other issues here around retention of industrial land, brownfields, and those things. We wanted to move on and give you a little bit more broad information about the watersheds so that you kind of have both ends of the spectrum here in terms of the discussion. As you all know, the connections between these two things are really huge. Much of our industrial zoned land is located in very environmentally sensitive areas along the confluence of the Willamette and the Columbia. We also know that the issue is very significant. Our natural resource inventory identifies more than 6,000 acres of significant natural resource land. This is land in the river industrial areas, and it includes at-risk fish and wildlife species. And of those 6,000 acres, about 1,600 of those acres are high or medium-ranked natural resources. But of those 1,600, about a quarter of those we still haven't protected with any kind of environmental zone. So there's still significant work to do, and we haven't protected all of them. So the objective really in the comp plan is to have language that will help us, again, to do both of these things, to protect and retain prime industrial lands, but also to protect and restore natural resource lands. I think that's all I'll say right now. And then we asked Mike Abade and Jane to be here from BES because I think they have some both interests and some good knowledge on how these things come together. So, Tom.
Yeah. Mike. So now I'll sort of work my way through the table on page 10. And this is what we call our industrial land watershed health strategy and the different elements. From that, and as Susan mentioned earlier, we really came together with this strategy. We assembled a stakeholder work group that of a wide range of interests that met over a year, trying to work out both the policies that go into the comp plan as well as sort of the numbers here on what the strategies mean to try and sort of close this loop. And so we really came up with four different industrial land strategies to try and create the capacity, to create the room for the forecasted job growth. The first one was really about retention and protection, protect what we have, limit conversions, limit leakage of industrial land to other uses, to retail, to office, for housing. Our general employment zones allow housing as a conditional use, and we've seen development happen there. The second strategy, and this is a really big one, is around intensification. Can we, and this is really about supporting our existing businesses and assuming that 15% of our future job growth will happen through our existing businesses, through expansion on their existing sites. And the way we do that is through supporting those businesses with a series of freight infrastructure improvements that are part of the TSP project list, and also a number of policies about business climate and at least analyzing the regulatory cost burdens that we put on our businesses to try and support their growth and accommodate a lot of that, or 15% of that job growth through those businesses growing. Another big piece, and this really had sort of broad-based support, was a focus on brownfields. We have 600 acres of brownfields in our industrial area. We had a pretty extensive study that we got some funding from Metro to look at those brownfields and sort of the financial gap on how we can clean those up and redevelop and bring them back into productive use. It's important to note that, you know, out of those 600 acres of industrial brownfields, about half of them are outside the Superfund area. So this just isn't a Superfund, let's figure out, fix Superfund, but there's a lot out in the Columbia Corridor away from the riverbank in the Portland Harbor that we can get to work on sooner. When we looked at trends, we saw the private sector and we could forecast or expect the private sector to clean up about 40% of those brownfields. Those are the light brownish ones. And when we looked at our study, our financial feasibility study, we really focused on sort of the next 20%. And could we reasonably boost that cleanup rate to 60% and do that through a series of city and state incentives and we had a lot of talk about the incentives and not paying polluters, but looking at people who have sort of inherited or unknowingly bought into this, and figure that it is a heavy lift but a doable lift to get to 60%. And a lot of that relies on working with the state and being able to capture through tax credits or some other mechanism the income tax revenue that comes off of the new jobs that locate on these cleaned up sites.
But ask my question. Okay, so you're talking about the state giving tax credits, which, you know, is no skin off our nose, but are you also envisioning that we would have to come up with some resources ourselves through tax breaks or some other mechanism?
Yeah, it's a shared, it could be tax abatements on the new improvements that go on the cleaned up sites, and other sort of, I forget what else. We had a number of other strategies in there. I would say when we looked at in our study, and we'll get you a summary of this, is the payback periods for industrial lands are long, if you just look at city tax abatements and city resources, 20 plus years for some areas, some industrial areas. When you start folding in the income tax revenue and get some sort of revenue sharing agreement with the state, those drop to less than 10 years. In terms of being able to pay back the gap, the financing gap, and the cleanup costs. We do, the state, a couple of sessions ago, there was a bill passed that allowed for forgivable loans and also a revenue sharing agreement. If the city fronted the money, the state would pay it back from income tax revenue off the back end. So the city would still be taking the risk up front. But it could be more generous and it could be easier, but there are at least some existing mechanisms there where we could think that with a active brownfield program, we could drag the state to the table.
So we're predicting, or right now forecasting, a 60% reclamation of brownfields in our next 20-year? I think you said
yes.
It could go as high as 60.
Yes.
Okay. So I guess my question is, what's been the reclamation rate in the last 20 years? Looking back 20 years, what's been our success rate?
When we look back at the development trends, it's been about 40% of the brownfields that are out there are turning over. And so what we want to do is how can we boost that to get that higher level of achievement?